Welcome to Upvote, a politics podcast from Wired and Ars Technica UK. Each week until the election, we're discussing the increasingly important relationship between politics and technology, which more and more is coming to define political life, and kind of life everywhere. I'm Roland Manthorpe, Associate Editor of Wired, and with me as always is Kelly Fiveash, News Editor of Ars Technica. Hi Kelly.
Hello.
This week we're going to be looking at the ever-present topic of fake news. And to do that, we're joined by our special guest, Will Moy, founder and director of Full Fact, the UK's independent fact-checking charity. Will has fact-checked politicians in three referendums, the Leveson Inquiry, the general election in 2015, and now, of course, in 2017 once again. Will, how's the campaign been so far?
Well, three cheers for democracy. We sat in the office with the rolling news on two different screens. The rumours came out that the Prime Minister was going to announce a snap election. I posted on Facebook, please, not a snap election. The announcement came out. We pulled our plan out of the drawer. 2 days of planning, 2 weeks of preparation, and now we're launched.
And from your perspective, what's been the main issue? What's the thing that people really want their facts checked on?
Do you know what? The biggest thing at the moment is how little the political parties have said. We don't really know what they want to do. We don't really know what it's going to cost. We don't really know what they want out of Brexit. So we're waiting for manifesto launches, which we think are going to happen next week. And maybe we'll start getting some flesh on those bones.
We're going to be looking at the issue of fake news, facts, where they come from, where they can be found, and whether they can be located by automated fact-checking, something Full Fact has begun work on recently. But first, we have to talk about the events of the last week, because it's been an incredibly eventful period, especially in this area of what we might call techno-politics. So, on Friday, we had the local election results, which went extremely well for the Conservatives and varying degrees of badly for everyone else. Then, later that day, and 2 days before the final poll in the French general election, a link to a huge trove of files appeared on 4chan's poll forum, otherwise known as the armpit of the internet. And it looked like, or it seemed to suggest, that Emmanuel Macron's campaign had been hacked. Of course, we'd seen something similar during the US election, and I have to admit I felt a dark sinking feeling, as it seemed as if events might be repeating themselves. Kelly, you've been covering this story. It was the Russians, wasn't it?
It's still not clear, Roland. A number of experts have fingered the Russian hacking collective, known as Fancy Bear. But who knows? That's the same group that's behind the attacks on Clinton's presidential election campaign from last year. It's a murky, murky world, and lots of reporters are trying to get to the bottom of this story.
Because Fancy Bear, they were actually inside the Clinton campaign for months and months before they were discovered, weren't they? We did a really interesting piece with CrowdStrike, looking at that.
Yeah, no, absolutely, they were. And, you know, there are all sorts of issues there, not least that Clinton's team weren't really prepared for hacking on that scale. They didn't have two-factor authentication enabled for their email accounts. That's a whole other... a very long story, but it seems like Macron was prepared, his campaign team were prepared. They claim to have kind of tried to outfox the hackers on this occasion. The way that our reporter Sean Gallagher has described it is as a kind of honeypot for the hackers. So basically, it's a very complex thing, but it seems like the campaign team basically put in false information and false login accounts and things like that to try and flush out the hackers.
So it's as if you let the burglar come into your house, but you leave a whole bunch of gold and jewellery. Bear with me on this. I leave a whole bunch of gold and jewellery and lying around, and you've tagged it so that when it gets tried to sell on, then you know who's done it.
I guess that's it. It's the online equivalent, if you like. It's described as cyber blurring, apparently, which is a new term for me. I've not heard that one before. I don't know if it's going to catch on. But it's still going on. It's hard to say who to believe as well. You know, obviously, at the moment, what we're hearing is that Macron's digital team are heroes, if you like, for flushing out the bad guys. But we don't have all the facts yet, so it's hard to say.
And in a way, what appears most effective is Macron's political strategy and the way he dealt with that. So it'll be interesting to see if that catches on. Of course, other election campaigns will be worried about this. And the next big election, at least in the Western world, is here. Do you think, is it possible to say if any UK political party is going to get hacked?
Again, who knows? But the one thing I would say is that it would arguably be very difficult to dig the dirt on Theresa May. And the reason I say this is that while she was Home Secretary and she was doing that for years, she was campaigning very hard for what's colloquially known as the Snoopers Charter, which is now the Investigatory Powers Act. And so you would assume that she's pretty wise to hack in and you know, the kind of systems that so-called bad guys use to try and attack a political campaign and so on. You know, I imagine that probably there is a good digital team in place and that they're looking at this all the time. The other key thing is that this isn't new. It's kind of become sexy to talk about it. And, you know, the national newspapers are really getting to grips with this now. So the whole issue is being amplified, not just online, but offline as well. But actually, you know, I think the government are probably quite well prepared for this.
Ah, the Labour Party. That's the question.
It's a very good question.
Maybe we'll find out.
Yeah.
The deep sigh of someone who covers this regularly.
Yes.
So that's what we know so far. And this really sets the scene when it comes to talking about fact-checking and fake news. We've got hackers linked to the Russian state. We've got groups online, especially in the US, deliberately using social media to spread misleading information. So, Will, what can fact-checkers do?
Okay, well, let's start with why we started doing Full Fact in the first place. We didn't have, you know, this sense that Russia was sending disinformation all over the world. We didn't think that much about bored teenagers hacking politicians' email accounts or even potentially government agents hacking politicians' email accounts. It was the basic fear that politicians and other people in positions of power and influence might lie to us. And in doing that, they might cause us to make choices we wouldn't otherwise want to make. And what fact-checkers basically do is look at the claims that people make that matter, and then we ask, where did that come from? Can you back it up? And if you can't back it up, will you correct the record?
And you've been doing this since 2010?
We've been doing it since 2010.
So what has changed then since you started?
Everything. So, you know, we started, you know, that classic vein of fact-checking. How do we hold, if you like, power to account? And now we've seen the Leveson Inquiry early in our life. So the newspapers, hacking and accuracy and all of those standards questions. We've seen the three referendums we covered, AV, Scotland and the EU. And we've seen the general elections. And we've gone from those lame conversations people used to have about, will this be the first internet election, to it's obviously an internet election. You wouldn't think to ask the question. And actually, the fact that it's an internet election means we need to know what people are saying online. We need to actually think about how information spreads. We need to think about, can you seed information in some crazy corner of the internet that then spreads and becomes part of mainstream media? We need to understand how people share information with each other and how governments and political campaigns can stimulate that. We need to understand how targeted information and targeted advertising can affect the way we all vote, whether or not other campaigns can see it or challenge it.
Yeah, because we want to come on to that later. But first, on the question of fact-checking, does it work?
Yes, but it depends what you're trying to do with it. Let's imagine you're at a party. It's an awful party and somebody's decided to discuss politics and somebody's lipping off at you about their political opinions. And then somebody else walks in the room and says, look, I have a PhD in this topic and you're wrong. Would you expect anyone at that party to be grateful and instantly on the spot change their minds? Of course not. And if your idea of what fact-checking is that we should turn up, tell the world they're wrong, and expect everybody to thank us, then of course it's not going to work. But what we do is actually something different. Lots of people want information they can trust, and we give people information they can trust. We give people sources so they can check things for themselves. Everything we do links to its sources. But then we go to the next step. When people get things wrong, we ask them to correct the record. Politicians, journalists, campaign groups, and very often they do. We've had the Prime Minister, the former Prime Minister, stand up in the House of Commons and say, the Honourable Lady should listen to Full Fact. We've had the same Prime Minister publish a correction on the record in the House of Commons when he made a mistake. And that's how we make a difference. Firstly, we give people information they can trust. Secondly, we make sure that other people aren't giving people information they cannot trust.
Because there is this argument, I'm sure you've heard it, that fact-checking makes things worse. That by repeating the misleading claim, you draw attention to it,
yep,
people might think, oh yeah, no, maybe that is wrong. But yep, a few days later, all they remember is that, well, let's put a bust to this this claim, that there was a really big bust with a big number on it.
Yep.
And that's what sticks in the mind. And somehow by debunking it, you've actually made it bigger.
So let me just say that the referendum was almost a masterclass for voters in why they shouldn't trust politicians. And that's deeply depressing. On both sides, the campaigns were at least pushing their luck with the facts. But that's called the backfire effect. It's the idea that telling somebody something is wrong actually reinforces it in their own minds for one reason or another. It comes out of a piece of research done by a guy called Brendan Nyhan at Dartmouth University in the US. A single piece of research is kind of the hook on which a lot of this stuff hangs. He did some more research later and found that actually those conclusions weren't so certain. So it's a really ironic example of something where actually we don't really know psychologically what happens when you give people fact-checking. And we're promoting a big research project at the moment with a group called First Draft to actually understand that kind of thing more. But one of the lessons we've learned from that is when we do a fact check, we don't repeat in the headline the claim that we are fact checking, because that does give it more circulation than it would have had otherwise. And that does risk kind of reinforcing misleading information. But at the moment, a lot of that conversation backfire effect is over-egging a very, very limited research base.
Okay. Obviously, the problem with fact checking is that on the internet, there are seemingly infinite number of facts that need to be checked, and we've seen this week that Four Facts is working with Facebook and Google now, and the idea is to try to help users rather than the ad giants themselves have a better understanding of the spread of disinformation online. So can you briefly tell us a bit more about that initiative, please, Will?
Yeah, so I mean, actually, we've been working with both Google and Facebook for a little while now on different things. One of the things we started doing is publishing our fact checks using a special markup called Claim Review Schema, which means that it can be ingested by Google and by other places to be reused. So now if you Google something that we have fact checked, you might find in your search results the claim and conclusion that we have written right there on Google for you, with a link straight to Full Fact saying fact checked by Full Fact. And that kind of integration makes it much more useful for Google searchers.
What's an example of that then? What kind of claims are
Jeremy Hunt said recently is that it costs £230,000 to train a doctor. That's the example I always type into Google when I want to demonstrate this, so it's fresh in my mind. It sort of does, but it doesn't cost the government £230,000 because some of that is student loans. So it's one of those claims which is in one sense accurate, but if you think that's the cost of a taxpayer, that's not true. But if you type that into Google, you would see the fact check, or certainly I see the fact check. Google's so personalized, who knows? But you will see the fact check from Full Fact at the top with a claim there, the beginning of our conclusion, and a link to click through to Full Fact. And what that's beginning to do is show how fact-checking can be reused. So it's not just a website you go to, but it starts being a resource that we can pull into lots of different products.
So do you think that it's a bit cheeky of the likes of Facebook, you know, multi-billion pound company, to be farming out this kind of fact-checking to organisations such as Full Fact?
Well, it's a really good question. I actually have quite a lot of respect for the idea that Facebook should not be the arbiters of what is true on the internet. I don't think Full Fact should be the arbiters of what is true on the internet either. I think all of us should read things and be careful. But I do think that independent, non-partisan fact-checking matters, and I think getting that out to more people on Facebook is an important thing to do. I think we have seen over the last year, particularly since the US elections, the internet platforms stop, think, is this my problem? Is this my problem? This is my problem. Okay, this is my problem. And begin to sort of think, okay, what are we going to do about it? And frankly, with Facebook, I think I would like to have seen them move further and faster. We have been promoting an educational campaign with them on how people can be aware of false news. But actually, I want to see them do more to make it easy for people to spot false news. So I think Facebook has made a good start. I think supporting us is important. I think some of the work we've done together is work I'm proud of. But I also think Facebook has a lot more to do.
Is it right to refer to the likes of Facebook as a platform, though? I mean, they're not benign, are they?
They're not benign. That is definitely not for a fact checker to answer. You can decide who is malign or benign for yourself. There's this kind of big and I think slightly arcane debate about whether Facebook is a platform or a publisher. I think it's slightly misleading debate because actually they're sort of both. On the one hand, they are the place where you and I share things with our friends. And if anyone wants to get in the way of me sharing things with my friends, I have a big problem with that. On the other hand, they're a place where organizations, including Wires, Ars Technica, and Full Fact, all publish stuff and can pay to promote it, so more people see it than they otherwise would. And that's a bit of a grey area. And then in a third way, they're a publisher in the sense of when they publish something like the top 10 trending topics down the side of Facebook, actually they are making choices that massively influence everybody's experience of Facebook and therefore basically the internet. So they have different responsibilities in different places. And I'm not sure debating the language is as interesting as debating what things should you be responsible for.
The other day, Facebook published a full-page newspaper ad giving some clues to people how they might spot fake news. What did you make of that?
Well, we stuck our logo on it. So this is a educational campaign that we partnered with Facebook to run. It actually ran last month, I think, a few weeks ago, a lifetime ago, on Facebook itself. You might have seen notifications on your Facebook feed saying, basically Facebook saying, we're worried about false news. Here are some tips about how you can spot it. And in the UK, if you clicked through to those tips, at the bottom you'd see in partnership with Full Fact and our logo. And what we've done this week is extend that to running national newspaper ads. And those tips are basically asking people to do two things. One is say, what is the source of this and can you trust it? The classic question that journalists ask all the time. The second is learn a bit more about the internet. So we all know that we get those dreadful emails, the ones from, you know, somebody in Nigeria who's, just got an absolute fortune that they want to give you. And all you need to do is click on that pretty little link to something that looks a lot like a bank's website and give your bank details and then you'll be happy ever after. And now we're seeing news sites using the same phishing techniques, news sites that are dressed up to look like a proper well-recognized news site, but actually are something completely different, full of hoaxes, full of false information. And a lot of people who aren't as familiar with the internet as everyone listening to this podcast aren't so aware of those kinds of gaps. So some of the tips are about things like if the web address looks wrong, if the dates look wrong, if a photo looks like it's been reused from somewhere in the past, that might actually be true, and you need to be on your guard. So our basic message is, if you're not sure about something, don't share it. And if all of us choose not to share things that don't stack up, that will make a big dent on how far false information spreads online.
And this kind of educational initiative is the start of a wider tech-based pushback against fake news, right? And the one of the ideas that's often floated is automated fact-checking by robots. I don't know exactly if that's the right, or fact-checking by AI. And you've been working on this, right? So tell us a bit more about the project that you're looking at.
Yeah, and I mean, you must remind me to run home to the office because I think I've forgotten to wind up the fact checkers today. We are a long way away from having fully automatic fact checking in the sense of, you know, that near human intelligence that can read some claim coming out of the mouth of a politician or a campaigner or anywhere else, dive off to the internet, find the answer and tell you the answer in beautiful prose. But if you look at what our fact checkers do every day, we have some really, really skilled staff. We have a statistician, a social researcher, we have a legal specialist, a trained but not practicing lawyer, an economist, and so on. And they do really hard work, lots of it, and some of it's quite mechanical. Some of it is actually basically, we've seen this claim before, let's flag it up that somebody's repeating it. Or we've seen this type of claim before. I know exactly what spreadsheet to go to. I know exactly what number I'm looking for. Let's just check the latest version of these figures and see if they're right. And those kinds of mechanical things are things that you can seriously think about automating. Andrew Ng has been writing recently. He was the head of AI for both Google and Baidu. He's been writing recently about what AI can do for us. And he said, in the Industrial Revolution, we were freed from physical drudgery. Artificial intelligence should free us from mental drudgery. And actually, that's a really exciting prospect. So rather than having my very, very talented colleagues watching out for people repeating claims we've already fact-checked, why not get a computer to do it? when a computer can read everything said in Parliament in half a second, that's pretty exciting. So we're building monitoring tools that will read everything said in Parliament, read everything said in the news, read TV subtitles in real time, and instantly flag when people are saying things that we have fact-checked in the past that don't stack up. So that's phase one. And then the next step is to say, what kinds of claims can we automate the checking of? So, okay, we can't just take arbitrary language and turn it into coherent claims and go and check it. But actually, there are some kinds of claims that are quite predictable. They're said in standard ways. So claims about statistics. Is crime rising? Is X rising? Is some noun rising? Well, you can start to spot those kinds of claims, and you can think about, we know where this data is, and then the special source that fact checkers add is all of that data has caveats, it has things you need to know about it to reuse it. So we can start putting that in a structured form, put that all together and get something that cuts out a lot of the mechanics of fact checking and gives fact checkers the tools to do more work faster and better.
Do you think this is helping to improve the online conversation, though? I mean, you know, before we had Facebook and various other social media sites, you know, the internet actually has been around for a long time, and people have been on forums and all these different parts of the web. And only now, arguably, it's gone mainstream, but perhaps that's just because the national newspapers and so on are catching up with something that we all knew about a long time ago. So, you know, how is Full Facts helping that conversation to kind of not be in the gutter?
Well, I mean, if people want to have a conversation in the gutter, that's entirely their choice.
Maybe, yep.
It's not our job to tell people where to have their conversations or what to think. But we would like people to have accurate conversations in and about gutters. And it's our job to make sure people have all the gutter and sewage information they want. So on the kind of automated piece, this stuff is absolutely at the cutting edge right now. We were sort of the first people talking about it, but we've been working on it since 2013. We're hoping to make some big announcements in the rest of the year about how we're going to take that forward. But we have a team, a techie team at the moment, hard at work during the election, trying to make those tools useful in time for the live TV debates that are coming up during the election. To extend that then to the internet is, you know, the next frontier. And we need to think carefully about how accurate is it. We need to assess and evaluate how well is it working before we even think about just sending it out to sort of spider the web and correct everyone. But we all know that XKCD comment, you know, come to bed, says, you know, the beautiful stick figure in bed. I have a stick figure hunched over his computer. His, I assume, computer says, oh, no, I can't. Somebody is wrong on the internet. And I don't think it's our job to solve those problems. In the same way that I don't think anyone wants a fact checker tapping them on the shoulder in the pub and saying, look, I'm sorry, mate, you've got the wrong end of a stick. I think it's important to question the claims of people in positions of power. I think it's important to jump in when claims that are influencing the decisions we all make together are spreading. And I think that's the point where you want to make a difference on the internet. But I don't really want to tap everybody's Twitter account on the shoulder and say, here's a DM telling you how wrong you are about everything. I'm not sure that's our job.
Okay. So, I mean, how does that fit in with, you know, tabloid newspapers and spurious claims and, you know, this kind of history that we've had, certainly in this country, of being very outspoken, incredibly partisan, and owning the conversation in that way, and probably this will continue for this election as well. It's more likely, surely, that the tabloids will be the ones kind of in control of it, and perhaps broadcasters too, rather than the Facebooks and Twitters of this world.
I mean, it's a really interesting point, that. So in this country, and perhaps surprisingly to you and me and people on this podcast, still 2/3 of people's main source of news is television. So somebody described it as, yeah, the internet is coming, but TV is exit pursued by a snail. But for a younger generation, of course, the internet is massive, but overall, television really matters. So the fight about what gets on the 6 o'clock news, what gets on the 10 o'clock news, is still really important. And, you know, the Prime Minister yesterday, as we're recording this, sat on the sofa of the BBC One show with her husband, and that stuff is shaping the election, and we need to be really aware of how important that is.
Will you be fact-checking whether or not Philip does take out the bins?
No part of my career aspirations involves standing outside number 10 with a telephoto lens trained on the dustbins. But maybe, just maybe, seeing as you've made that challenge. I'll go and see if I get arrested. But seriously, so our broadcasters, of course, are covered by legal requirements to be accurate and to be impartial, and we can all argue about how successful they are, but, you know, at least they are more or less trying, and obliged to try. Our newspapers aren't. And when the Leveson inquiry came around, obviously it was focused on hacking, it was focused on privacy and intrusion and that sort of thing. But it was about reforming the press standards system. And 9 out of 10 complaints to the old Press Complaints Commission involved accuracy. So Full Fact, which was one of the highest volume users of the PCC at the time, said, we need to explain how this stuff works. And we submitted almost 100 pages simply of examples of press getting things wrong, and what happened when we asked the press to correct things. And Lord Justice Leveson drew quite a lot of conclusions out of that evidence. And one of the things he said was there is clear evidence of newspapers allowing their political agenda to override the facts. And I think that conclusion would still hold true now. I don't think that's a very bold thing to say. So newspapers are absolutely entitled to make whatever political arguments they like. It's not our job to have a political argument with anybody. But we will be checking the facts they're using to back those arguments up. And we will be asking them, where necessary, to correct the record. And also to correct the record if they publish facts claimed by politicians that don't stack up. You know, I don't think any politician should get a free pass just because they're publishing an opinion piece in a newspaper. So they have responsibilities of accuracy, whatever their opinions are. And it's our job to kind of help them get on the right side of that. And actually, we're working with loads of the newspapers to get our fact-checking out. If you're in London and you read the Evening Standard, you'll see fact-checks in there every day from Full Fact. And we're working with lots of the other newspapers as well to make sure that people are getting reliable information. So I think there's more awareness now that people really want information they can trust.
Okay, and on the campaign itself, I mean, what are you seeing so far? Have you got any kind of horrible lies that you've dispelled?
So actually, the campaign so far, from my perspective, my colleagues are hard at work. We normally have 6 fact checkers. We doubled that, and that all started on Monday, the new people arriving. The campaign, from my perspective, has been getting the crowdfunder launched so we can actually fund some of this stuff. It's been building the partnerships. We're working with places like the Institute for Fiscal Studies, the Migration Observatory at Oxford University, installing Wi-Fi access points and building chairs so we can actually let people sit down and connect to the internet in our office. So we've been doing this huge logistical thing for the last few weeks, just simply to get the election centre up and running. And we've only just got all of the team kind of fully working there. As I say, actually, the politicians have been kind of surprisingly quiet on a lot of issues so far. And I'm really waiting for them to get serious about telling us what they think and what they're going to stand for. We are seeing some fact checks, which we're really not sure how they stack up. I've just finished editing a piece on Labour's promise to spend £300 million to give us 10,000 new police officers. Kind of scratch bit of fact-checking for you. £300 million divided by 10,000 doesn't add up to that much money. It's 30,000 per head. That's roughly the payroll cost of a police officer. So who's paying for the recruitment? Who's paying for the training? Who's paying for the equipment? Who's paying for the uniforms, the police stations to put them in, and all the rest of it? The best figures we've been able to find suggest that that's almost half as much again as the salary costs. So the £300 million is not going to go as far as 10,000 police officers. Same time on Sunday, Jeremy Hunt was on the political TV shows on Sunday, which I'm sure we all watch back to back. Andrew Marr followed by Robert Peston's, you know, Sunday morning fun. He was saying that we have something like 15,000 more nurses, and we can't justify that using the official figures. I don't think we've been looking at that and trying to figure out where he got that from. But I'm still looking for the final version of that. But so we are seeing things that need to be checked out. We are watching these shows, but actually most people don't tune into an election until the final week. Most people, if you look at our traffic graphs, if you look at, you know, the TV figures, anything, it's the final week when people really tune in and decide what they think about things. So one of the things we're trying to do is prepare lots of content. So in time for the live TV debates, in time for that final week when people are really paying attention, we can reach the widest group of people possible.
We talked about the Macron campaign at the beginning. And what was clear when you looked at the process of how that hack, that leaked information or the hacked information got out there, is that there are certain groups dedicated to spreading this stuff. and they seem to be mainly coming from the dark web. What is there anything that fact-checking can do to help with that?
We're going to try to find out. So we have teamed up with First Draft. First Draft are a global network that brings together journalism organizations and internet platforms to try and work out what we do about disinformation and misinformation online. And they've just got done checking the French elections, where they ran something called Crosscheck, which is 39 different newsrooms collaborating to check what was going on during the French elections, monitoring the online space and all of that. And we've teamed up with them, and this is a project that Google and Facebook are both backing, to start to think about how we fact-check the online world and how we monitor the conversations that are happening and how we can bring fact-checking and verification into that space in the most useful way. For full fact, we have to figure this stuff out. You know, we sort of almost started a world away back when actually you weren't so worried about the influence of the internet on society in general. And now we realize we have to scale things up to internet scale, and actually figuring out what does that look like, how do you do that effectively, experimenting with techniques for monitoring what's trending and what's growing and getting in early enough to make a difference, and doing proper research on how do you present information so that people will take it in and it won't just bounce straight off.
Because one thing I wonder is whether you need people to care about the difference between truth and facts for this sort of thing to make a difference?
Yeah, quite. So we all do. We all care about being misled, and we all care about people lying about our own lives. The question is, can you translate that into a broader thing of, if I believe something and it's wrong, I care enough to change my opinion? So none of us will tolerate being told we have a job when we don't have a job. And that's the kind of thing that alienates people from politicians. If somebody says you've never had it better, then if you feel you have had it better and you want it a lot better, then you're not going to take that coming from your politicians. So I don't think it's the case that anyone is completely indifferent to the facts. The facts are the lives we all lead. The question is, how do you translate that into the middle of a political argument and turn that into, you know, you're boldly saying, I think this, and I have good evidence that what you think is simply not true. How do I get that across to you in a useful way?
So we're not living in a post-truth world, I seem to hear you saying. And I wonder what that means for debates like, for example, climate change, right?
Yeah. So Brian Cox put it brilliantly. He said, you can possibly campaign in a post-truth way, but you cannot govern in a post-truth way. Sooner or later, people notice the seas coming, you know, over East Anglia. Sooner or later, people notice whether they have got a job or whether they haven't got a job. You know, there's only so long you can tell people stories about the world that contradict the evidence of their own eyes.
Of course, in the long run, we're all dead.
In the long run, we're all dead, but that long run is getting further and further away. We've been quite lucky with healthcare advances in this country. And in, you know, if you think about Soviet Russia, for example, places where the official version of events and people's lived experiences were a million miles apart, that's the sort of a vision you have to have if you think we genuinely live in a post-truth world. I don't think we do. I think we live in a world in which it is increasingly easy to make up credible-looking sources of information for any point of view, and it's becoming harder and harder to know what to trust. And actually, we all have an easy answer to that, which is I won't trust anything. But deciding not to trust anything is deeply, deeply damaging, deeply harmful, and basically the end of democracy. So the big question for fact checkers is going to be, how do we give people good reasons to trust stuff that deserves to be trusted? And how do we help people make good decisions not to trust things that don't deserve to be trusted? So actually preserving the space of trusted information that contradicts something you want to believe is going to be really hard.
Are we actually patronising the electorate by kind of spoon-feeding them facts? Can't they work that out for themselves?
Yeah, absolutely. Sometimes you need about 2 weeks to answer very simple questions, so if you want to, crack on. A good example of that was the referendum last year. My colleague Amy ended up fact-checking this claim that something like 8% of only 8% of British businesses export to the rest of the EU. couldn't be a more blindingly obvious question to want the answer to. If we're going to make the decision we were making last year, you would kind of want to know the answer to that question. We ended up ringing about four different government departments, HMRC, the business department, the Office for National Statistics, whoever else, saying, have you got any figures on this? And none of them could come up with a decent figure. Eventually, we traced it back and we found that there are three different ways of measuring this and none of them will give you an accurate number. Yes, absolutely. We should all be on our guard. We should all use and trust our own judgment. We should all do our own research. Full fact is there because we can't all be expected to do that all the time. We've all got lives to lead. And sometimes people want information they can trust that they can check out for themselves. We link to all of our sources. You don't have to take our word for anything and we don't want you to take our word for anything. But we will do the research for you.
Controversial question then. Isn't that the job of people like me, journalists?
Yeah.
Okay.
One of the first people we hired to be a fact checker at Full Fact left the national newspaper. And when he told his boss he was leaving to come to Full Fact, his boss said, oh, fact checkers, we used to have those.
That's very damning, isn't it?
It's really damning. But it's also, you have to have some sympathy. Mm-hmm. Media outlets are now publishing in more places, more quickly, on more topics than ever before. They're doing so on smaller budgets. The squeeze on the news industry, by and large, has been pretty huge. And so there has been less capacity for this kind of work. Actually, you don't necessarily need every newsroom in the country doing the work that Full Fact does. You know, it's pretty much the same research whoever's doing it, or at least that's what we would aim to achieve. So, yes, I want to see journalists doing this. I think journalists should be calling out politicians. It frustrates me hugely when politicians get to put numbers in a press release or claims in a press release and then refuse to back them up in public, refuse to say where they got them from. And I think journalists need to do a much better job of holding power to account in that way. But I'm not sure every journalist in the country needs to be bent over a spreadsheet. And just realistically, I'm not sure there are enough journalists left to do this kind of work. And one of the areas we see that, quite apart from tech, is crime reporting. It used to be that there were court reporters all over the country and we had a really good idea of what was going on in the courts and they were specialists who understood all the weird language and the crazy dress codes and all the rest of it. And now we don't have that kind of journalism. And actually, I think probably our legal system suffers because of it. And we should be wary of that happening in lots of other forms of journalism as well. So yes, I'd like to see journalists doing more of it, but I'm not going to knock them all the time for that.
Last time we spoke, you embarrassingly called me out on one particular fact.
I'm so sorry.
About the number of, I think it was the percentage of people who weren't born in the UK who live in the UK. I wonder, just before we go, what do you think are the most common misconceptions that people have?
You know what? I would love to know the answer to that question.
Of course, you're a fact checker. You won't wildly speculate.
Give me some proper research. So we actually did, and if anyone wants to Google it, with Ipsos Mori, we did a poll called The Perils of Perception Research last year, and they've done a series of these things, asking people what they think are the answers to factual questions and finding out, basically, that most of us are pretty wildly wrong on everything. And actually, the proportion of immigrants in the UK is a really good example. And I can't remember that exact number off the top of my head, so I'm not going to bluff it. But I will tell you the proportion of people in the UK born in the rest of the EU is 5 out of every 100 people. And I mention that because when we asked people last year, the average guess was 15 out of every 100 people. People were wildly wrong about it. And people who wanted to vote Leave were saying on average 20 out of every 100. People who wanted to vote Remain were saying on average 10 out of every 100. So everybody was wildly wrong. But how wrong you were was somehow likely to be associated with how you plan to vote. And I think it's a really fascinating demonstration of how good information can help us make whatever we consider to be good choices. And I want to make sure everyone has the information that lets them do that.
Where can we go to look at your facts?
Fullfact.org. We're Full Fact on Twitter. We're Full Fact on Facebook. We are on the Wire podcast, hopefully maybe again someday. And we are also crowdfunding. So come to our website. If you think this work matters, and you should think this work matters, please come to our website and give us a boost.
Of course, we'd love to have you on again. Will, thank you so much for talking to us about facts. And thank you, Kelly, as always.
Thank you.
Thank you both.
Goodbye.